Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with How Stuff Works and iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And today, we're going to look at a classic episode that aired back in July of 2012, July 16th, to be precise. And it is titled, Tech Stuff Looks at Supercomputers. This was a fun discussion to have with my former co-host, Chris Paulette, because I, grew up in an era of supercomputers and only had sort of a vague idea of what that term meant for many years. I'm sure there was a time when I was a kid where I thought of it as a computer that wore a cape. But as it turns out, it gets a little more complicated than that. Let's listen in.
So, Chris, if I were to ask you, just off the top of your head, how would you define a supercomputer, what would you say?
Well, if I hadn't already made the joke, I would have said it was a computer in a cape and tights. But no, honestly, I would say a supercomputer is a computer that can do a lot more calculations in a shorter period of time than the machines sitting on our desktop.
Yeah, I think of it as sort of the bleeding edge of what a computer is capable of doing.
Yeah, something that still fills a room, even though typical computers these days don't need to fill a room because it's that big. Still has that much computing power.
Right, right. And the term comes from the 1960s. And in order to really kind of understand the span of this, I think I was going to talk a little bit about the last computer I could find that was a powerful computer that existed before people started talking about supercomputers.
Okay.
Which was the IBM 7030 Stretch.
Yes, that was the one that was made with elastic.
Yes.
Gain a couple pounds, your computer can still, fit.
It was Mr. Fantastic of the computer world. No, because it was not a supercomputer. It took up 2,000 square feet back in the day, this being the early 60s.
That's bigger than my house.
2,000 square feet. It cost $13 million, which if you were to translate to today's cash would be $91 million.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of cash. So that was the fastest computer at the time until a fellow named Seymour Roger Cray showed up.
Ah, yes, Mr. Cray.
Yeah, Cray ends up being a big name in supercomputers, particularly in the 60s, 70s, and up to the mid-80s. That was the name in supercomputers. And he was working for a company called Engineering Research Associates, or mm-hmm. ERA, which actually grew out of a naval operation, being the U.S. Navy, not belly button.
I was going to say, was it covered in lint?
You were looking at me like, it's a belly button joke. No, no, not that. It was a Navy project. How about that? As in the military force, not the color. It was a Navy project that was all about code breaking.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there was this project about code breaking that eventually kind of spun off and became an actual company all on its own called Engineering Research Associates. And it branched out beyond code breaking, although it took all the code breaking work it could get.
Yeah. We talked about the Enigma some episodes back.
Yes,
now.
Yes, many.
And we were talking about the bomb. And yeah, those early, that was really the early application for supercomputers was,
yeah.
you know, needing to crunch a lot of data very quickly. And there weren't the kind of applications that we have now. We'll get into that, I'm sure, in just
yeah,
a few minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that was, you know, why would you need a supercomputer? You know, that's probably about the only thing I could think of where people were needing to crunch that kind of information as quickly as possible.
Right, yeah. And
defense.
Yeah, typically, especially with the early supercomputers, they were really designed for very specialized computing. So not necessarily specialized from the ground up for one particular type of computing, but
right.
they were not meant to be general computers. They were meant to do
Admiral computers, because they were in the Navy.
That's true. No, they were meant to do a specific task very, very well, and
right.
that's all they were meant to do.
Yeah.
Now, Cray had an interesting philosophy. He said, and this is a quote from him, he said, "Anyone can build a fast CPU. The trick is to build a fast system." And that was the secret to Cray creating the first supercomputer. He realized that if you created a processor that was really, really fast, that did not matter if it couldn't get the data it needed to execute operations upon fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw the need to create a system that would move data through very, very quickly. Not just process data, but move it. So that means it needs a lot of memory. It needs a very fast pathway from memory to processor.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of pieces that have to be put in place. And he saw this very early on. And so using that philosophy, he designed a computer back in 1962 that was called the CDC-6600. Now, CDC stands for Control Data Corporation.
Yeah. ERA was taken over by Remington Rand.
Yes.
And that's a name I remember because I, you know, still remember a lot of those old machine names from stuff that I found in my dad's collection. Of course, he was, you know, a mechanical engineer
mm-hmm.
Before he retired. And you know, so he was interested in all kinds of machines. And I didn't know what I was looking at the time, of course, you know, but there were all these science and computing magazines laying around. And that name I recognize. Also Unisys, because Remington Rand became Unisys.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a lot more of our listeners are familiar with that name. But he partnered with William Norris to start Control Data Corporation. Back in 1957. And really, at that point, the UNIVAC from Remington Rand and IBM were the computing companies.
I mean, yeah.
You know, IBM has been the heavyweight for so long.
Right.
But CDC was the first, you know, upstart to really make a dent in their stranglehold on the industry.
And Cray wanted to join CDC fairly early on, but apparently he was needed for a project that would not let him leave exactly when he wanted to. So once he did leave, that's when he designed the CDC 6600, which was officially announced in 1964. So designed in 62, announced 2 years later. And it was the first commercially successful supercomputer with a price tag of between $7 and $8 million, sometimes going up as high as $10 million, depending upon the configuration that the customer wanted. Now in today's cash, that would equal about $60 million. So $31 million cheaper in today's money than the Stretch computer. And it was actually much more powerful. It had 400,000 transistors and 100 miles of wiring. And it was the size of about four filing cabinets. So it was also significantly smaller than the Stretch. It didn't take up 2,000 square feet. The clock speed was around 100 nanoseconds. And it had 65,000 60-bit words of memory. So this is kind of an odd time in computing. We hadn't really settled on the 32, 64-bit kind of model. This was before that. It also used six high-speed drums as sort of a temporary storage area. It had a central storage that used magnetic tape. And it used the Fortran 66 compiler. The equivalent to today's machines means that it would have about a 10 megahertz processor.
Yeah.
Well, that could work up to 40 megahertz in speed.
Well, it could do 3 million floating point operations per second.
Yeah, those are flops.
Flops. I love that word.
Yeah, so 3 million, that would be a megaflop. 3 megaflops, right?
Yep, yep.
So we're going to get into lots of different flop terms later as well. They get incredibly huge.
Yeah. Of course, you have to keep it cool because otherwise it breaks out into a flop sweat.
That's true. Well, not the flop sweat part, but you do have to keep it cool. As we know, electronics, when you're running electricity through them, one of the byproducts is heat. And heat, as it turns out, is not a great thing for electronic components. It can make stuff expand. Contacts can lose connections so that stuff starts to malfunction. An entire system could shut down. So the CDC 6600 had a cooling system that was provided by a special chemical, Freon.
Really?
Yeah, they used Freon to cool the system. In fact, it was they would use Freon for a while before finally having to switch to a different coolant because Freon just wasn't efficient enough eventually. Now, at the 6600, it was still doing the job. So,
Cray was also an innovator in another way. The Stretch, IBM Stretch, the 7030, was sort of a hybrid machine. They had transistors and vacuum tubes in it. And that's, I think, why one of the reasons why Cray's machines were smaller. The 1604, which preceded the 6600, was the one of the very first to use transistors only. So the 6600 was also a transistor machine.
Yeah.
And so it would take up a lot less space than the vacuum tubes. And I would imagine that based on my knowledge, my personal knowledge of vacuum tubes, it might have been a little cooler simply because of that.
Yeah, I would imagine that they wouldn't have had to have as dramatic an AC system to keep the room bearable. Because vacuum tubes do put off a lot of heat. Another interesting IBM CDC connection here is that Thomas Watson Jr., which was IBM's he was IBM's CEO at the time, wrote a famous memo at that time to IBM employees. And he said, "Last week, Control Data announced the 6600 system. I understand that in the laboratory developing the system, there are only 34 people, including the janitor. Of these, 14 are engineers and 4 are programmers. Contrasting this modest effort with our vast developmental activities, I fail to understand why we have lost our industry leadership position by letting someone else offer the world's most powerful computer." Cray's response was reportedly, "Well, there's your problem." Essentially, Cray was saying that, you know, perhaps IBM's approach was a little burdened by size, that IBM had grown so large that to manage a project like this was very difficult to do because it was just too big. So that's an interesting idea, that an organization needed to be kind of small and nimble in order to pull something off like creating the world's fastest computer.
Mm-hmm.
He followed up the CDC 6600 with the 7600, which had a 65,536 60-bit word memory and a clock speed of 27 nanoseconds, and actually, in practice, ran about five times faster than the 6600. But then Cray left CDC, and he formed his own company, Cray Research.
Mm-hmm. 1972.
And in 1976, he introduced the Cray 1, which, if you've ever heard the Cray supercomputer, that's what this is. It's, mm-hmm. The Cray 1 was the first of those. It had a clock speed of its processor ran at 80 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And back at this time, these supercomputers were still using a single CPU.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting, too. These were single CPU systems. So it had an 80 megahertz processor, 64-bit system. It ran at 136 megaflops, so 136 million floating operations per second. And it had 1,662 printed circuit boards that made up the components of this computer.
Mm-hmm.
It cost between $5 and $8 million, depending on how you wanted it set up. And in today's cash, that's about $25 million. So we see that the processor speed is increasing,
mm-hmm.
and the price is coming down. Often the size of the computer is decreasing as well, although that also flip-flops over the years.
Right.
Because while the solid-state electronics definitely brought the size down, eventually the way we pack in more speed requires more space. But we'll get into that.
Okay.
So after the Cray 1 came the Cray XMP in 1982.
Yeah, this is interesting because Cray realized also, in addition to the fact that he knew that the components, the entire machine was important and not just a processor, he also realized that early on that parallel processing could also speed things up. Now, it's common for us to have multi-core processors in our desktop machines or laptops, or in fact, now we're starting to see them in our mobile devices.
Yes.
At the time in the 70s and 80s, this was still something sort of newish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that everybody realized. So the XMP actually was two Cray 1 computers linked together. And using those two machines together in a multi-processing effort, they could triple the performance of just one Cray 1.
Yeah.
Which is something interesting to note. And in 1985, the Cray 2 had four processors,
mm-hmm.
in the same machine, and that was the first to exceed 1 billion flops, as Britannica tells me.
Yeah, it actually could have up to 8 CPUs, the Cray 2. These machines often over time were upgraded. So the initial specs you would get when they were,
sure.
first released were one thing. And then by the end of the run of production, they would be better. I mean, which makes sense. I mean, we see that in computers all the time. We tend to call them different model numbers now, but same sort of thing happens.
Mm-hmm.
So back in 1982, you had the Cray XMP with 105 megahertz CPUs running around 200 megaflops each. And if they had up to four CPUs, you could get 800 megaflops going. And that was pretty impressive. It had the equivalent, by the way, of 128 megabytes of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you think about that. 128 megabytes of RAM in 1982, that was considered bleeding edge for a supercomputer.
Well, sure.
And the storage units for the Cray XMP were the size of a file cabinet, and they could hold up to 12 gigs of storage.
I was going to say, I have a flash drive in my bag with me that has 8 gigs.
Yeah, and you can find
costs less than $10.
You can find 20 gig or more flash drives, which, you know, you think about that. That's something that is small enough for you to carry on a keychain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, back in 1982, you had a file cabinet-sized device that could hold 12 gigs. And that was considered massive, like a massive amount of information.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, time really does change things, doesn't it? So, yeah, the Cray 2, that's when they switched from Freon to Fluorinert as their coolant.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but that sounds like a made-up alien name from an animated movie.
Technically, all names are made up.
I know, but
yeah, that's. I just blew your mind. What if there were no hypothetical questions?
Turn on the Glufenart.
Yes. So the Florinert, the reason why they switched was because they had, at that point, packed the components so tightly together that Freon was not efficient enough to cool them. So they switched from Freon to Florinert. And
what's that little Florinert I've had around? It's somewhere around
then
here.
Then they also had to figure out a new way to access the memory on the Cray 2, because at this point they had reached that point that Cray had mentioned earlier about creating a CPU that can process information faster than it can pull information in. So they found they would actually dedicate processors to getting data from memory and funneling it into the central processing units. And this was really important. It was what kind of led the way into threading and loading memory. CPUs that have that capability to load information from memory, preloading things, that kind of came out of this work. In fact, a lot of the advances that we see in personal computers are really possible because of the pioneering work that was done in supercomputers. It was stuff that found its way from the engineering of supercomputers into personal computers. Often a completely different sense of scale, but a similar approach. Now, after the Cray 2, that's when Japan started to produce some supercomputers that were actually faster than anything that was being produced in the United States. Mm-hmm. So up until this point, it was all U.S. That country dominated the supercomputer industry.
Right.
But in 1996, so this is, you know, again, the craze, if you will.
Well,
lasted from the 60s all the way into the 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, in 96, Japan introduced the SR2201, which had 2048 processors. So remember, Cray 2, that was up to 8 processors.
Mm-hmm.
The SR2201, 2048 processors.
Yep.
I count 2040 more processors with that computer than with the Cray 2.
Mm-hmm.
My math could be off. I'm an English major. And it could have up to 600 gigaflops of processing. That's kind of crazy.
I also feel like we would be remiss to mention the efforts of Danny Hillis. W. Daniel Hillis was a grad student at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, when he realized that distributing computing was the way of the future, if you will.
Yeah.
He started Thinking Machines Corporation in 1983. And this CM1, which was the first of his machines to come out in 85,
mm-hmm.
It had 65,536 one-bit processors grouped 16 to a chip.
Interesting. That's a really interesting approach.
Tiny, tiny processors.
Huh. Yeah.
So, you know.
Wow.
But yeah.
I didn't come across that in my research, which is why this is actually really like my mind is reeling as I'm thinking about that sort of architecture. That's really an interesting approach.
Well, it's interesting too to see how different. See, Jonathan and I do our research separately on purpose so that we come up with different things in a lot of cases. And so it's funny that I would have come across that. I also I think of Danny Hillis because I've seen his name a lot in things like the Long Now Foundation and people with he hangs out with people like Stuart Brand and Kevin Kelly. Fascinating people. But that was one of his contributions. And you see that in today's machines. I mean, we have this, you know, with us every day. But, you know, this is when we started to realize that you don't necessarily have to go by Moore's law and wait until next year's chip comes out with twice as many processors on it. You can do this by dividing up the work.
Yeah, and in fact, that's another good point about the SR2201, the computer from Japan, because in order to use these 2048 processors, there was a new development in computer science, which was called multiple instruction, multiple data, or MIMD.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, this is the idea of being able to solve problems by pulling in information from memory and feeding it to different processors that are all using different operations on that data to come to a single solution. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a single solution, but that's, I'm using that as an example for this explanation. So this MIMD approach is what allowed us to develop multi-core processors.
Yes.
Because in this case, we're still talking about single processors that are all grouped together. Eventually, we will get to the point where we have multi-core processors, where a single processor has multiple cores, and each core can work on part of a problem or separate problems to solve things faster, to get to a conclusion faster than they would if it was just one single processor, even if it was a really, really fast processor mm-hmm. working on a series of problems. So I always use this analogy. Imagine that you have one super smart math genius taking a math test, and the math genius is going through and solving all of these problems. And he or she is able to do this flawlessly, mm-hmm. right? Able to solve all the problems. But it takes a certain amount of time to get through the test. Then you give that same test to four above average math students. They're not geniuses, but they can hold their own.
Mm-hmm.
And you divide it up. Say, all right, you take this 1/4 of the test. You take this quarter. You take this quarter, and you take that quarter. And the four students together start to work. Those four students are very likely going to be able to finish the entirety of that test much faster, each of them working on a quarter of it, rather than the genius who is working on the full thing at the same time. Even though the genius is smarter and can work faster on each individual problem, collectively, those four students are going to solve that test faster.
Mm-hmm.
That's the philosophy behind both grouping cores together and making them a parallel processing unit, or taking a multi-core approach to a CPU.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and you can thank Danny Hillis for figuring out the idea of massively parallel computing.
Mm-hmm.
But it, you know, that's a problem though too, because instead of having two machines running side by side and linked together, mm-hmm. now you have to figure out how you're going to parse all those instructions between all those different processors.
Right.
So you have to have the software or the operating system that will give instructions to each of the processors actively and direct, essentially directing traffic.
Yes, this is kind
it's
of
hard.
Like
it's not a simple thing to figure out.
It reminds me of Intel's tick-tock approach to developing processors.
Mm-hmm.
You think of the tick being the physical machinery that's going to do the processing.
Right.
And you think of the talk as the software that's optimized to work on that physical hardware to make it really live up to its potential.
Right.
And then you have another tick where you've got an advancement in the physical hardware, but perhaps the last generation of software isn't really optimized to work on that. So you have to make new software. This is a continuation. In fact, that's one of the things that people say is a barrier to artificial intelligence, to the point of having a computer that has self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily that we can't reach the physical requirements we would need in order to have a computer be able to have some form of self-awareness. It's the idea that we could throw as much horsepower at the problem as we wanted to. Without the software, it just won't happen.
We'll be rejoining this classic episode in just a moment, but first let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's one company name we haven't really mentioned yet, and it's big. I mean, we talked about it a little bit just then, but not in the terms of supercomputers. It's a big name in computer architecture, but it wasn't a really big name in the whole supercomputer story, and that's Intel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Intel was not just sitting back during this whole time. Now, granted, Intel's main focus is on enterprise and consumer processors,
right,
which are not completely analogous to what is you find in supercomputers at this time.
Right.
That would change, but not immediately. But Intel did develop something called the Paragon,
mm-hmm,
which was supposed to be, you know, another fantastic supercomputer. And it could support up to 4,000 processors using this MIMD architecture.
Mm-hmm.
But it did not succeed in the market. It just sort of, well, it flopped in a different way.
The other kind of flop.
Yeah, the bad kind. So that didn't really go anywhere, but it did, again, sort of push this trend of parallel processing and MIMD.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese came out with a couple of other computers called ASCII Red and ASCII White. Intel also had an ASCII Red.
Well, actually, this goes back to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty mm-hmm, the United States signed. In 1996, they needed a certification program for the nuclear weapons that they had built up. And so what they started was the Accelerated Strategic Computing Initiative, ASCII, with only one I instead of ASCII characters.
Yes.
With two I's, just to clarify.
Yes, I'm glad you did.
Thank you. And ASCII Red, yes, was built at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Intel helped them out with that, and that was the first machine to get a teraflop.
Yeah, it was the first one to break the teraflop barrier. It did that with 6,200 megahertz Pentium Pro processors.
9,072 of them.
Well, 6,000 at first. It then eventually was upgraded. The very first one had 6,000.
Well, actually, that's what I had.
And the very last one had 9,298 Pentium 2 Xeon processors.
Yep.
And it actually hit 3.1 teraflops at the end of its production life.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like I said, you know, when we give these numbers, there are different ones because there's a certain amount that was available when the computer first premiered. Then there was like the average amount during the computer's lifetime, and then the amount that was available at the very end of its runtime. So these numbers do change a little bit depending upon which source you're reading and which version of the computer
right,
they're looking at.
Because,
right, again, these computers are – they come in a range of models, so not all of them are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Now, while we talk about playing games like chess, you know,
yeah,
that's one of the big consumer visibility issues with supercomputers. You don't see what supercomputers do. And that was a way for them, the IBM in particular, to achieve notice.
Yeah.
Was taking on people like Garry Kasparov,
right,
chess masters, mm-hmm, worldwide with a supercomputer. Can a computer outthink, quote unquote, outthink a human?
Yep.
Well, the point of ASCII was, again, one of those behind the scenes things. It was a very military thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was more like Whopper in war games, actually.
Shall we play a game?
Actually, exactly like that. The point was to simulate nuclear tests.
Yes.
And that was why they needed a lot of computing power and something, a machine that could run a lot of calculations very quickly, because they wanted to, you know, this is not something you want to do. Hey, well, let's test out 50 nuclear warheads.
Yeah.
This, you know, they wanted to do this with a computer simulation. And, so that's why they started the initiative. It was not a game, but a challenge.
Yeah.
Hey, let's keep coming up with newer, faster machines, because we need newer, faster machines to run nuclear simulations.
Yeah, and simulations in general were a big part of what these supercomputers were put to use for. I mean, like climatology, for example, weather predictions, that was a big requirement as well. Supercomputers have been put toward that to try and help map and predict climate change, mm-hmm. and just weather patterns, not just climate, but weather, day-to-day weather, and also other simulations as well, not to mention crunching data from facilities that generate lots and lots of information. So things like the SETI Institute mm-hmm. would
search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yes, they would use very powerful computers to try and crunch all the data they would get from radio telescopes. You also had things like the Large Hadron Collider and other super colliders that generate lots and lots of data, and they need these really fast computers in order to process the data and make it meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving on. So right around this time when the ASCII Red comes out, that's when there was a shift in supercomputing.
Mm-hmm.
So before, there were all these customized computers that had their own processors or had thousands of processors running together. But at this point, it became possible to actually build a supercomputer with off-the-shelf parts.
Yeah.
You could actually get enough computers together and link them together to perform as a supercomputer. And this was also when there became a shift to using the Linux operating system. So Linux kind of replaces Unix as the OS of choice for people who are designing supercomputers.
Which is nice, because now you can tell the company nurse never mind.
In 2002, Japan comes back with the ASCII White, where it's had a 35 teraflops computer. It was the NEC Earth Simulator, and it cost a hair under $1 billion, mm-hmm. 900 million. It's a lot of hairs, actually. 100 million is a lot of hairs. If anyone wants to give me a hair in that sense, I will take it. In 2004, IBM comes out with the BlueJean/L computer. It had 16,000 computer nodes, and each node had two CPUs.
I'm going to be singing Bowie the rest of the day now.
So, yeah, 32,000 CPUs ultimately, if my mm-hmm. math is correct. And then that could run at 70 teraflops, so twice as fast as the ASCII White. And a 2007 version of this could actually manage up to 600 teraflops, and it had 100,000 computer nodes, so 200,000 processors with that. Starting to get into some pretty ridiculous computers from, if you're looking at it as, hey, I own a computer that's got a single processor, this one has 200,000 of them.
Yeah, yeah. It also sort of makes Apple's claim in the late 90s sort of silly. Because the federal government classified a supercomputer, I can't remember exactly when it was. It was in the late 90s, and as a machine that would run a gigaflop. And IBM, when they were still running on PowerPC processors, there was a Mac that they advertised as being a supercomputer because it could reach a gigaflop.
Yes.
And I just thought – at the time, it was kind of weird to think about. But now it's just kind of silly when you take it in context. And these actual supercomputers at the time, a gigaflop is good, but no.
Right. So a megaflop is 1,000,000 floating operations per second.
Mm-hmm.
A gigaflop is 1,000,000,000 mm-hmm. floating operations per second. A teraflop is 1,000,000,000,000 floating operations per second.
Uh-huh.
Well,
and then there's a petaflop,
which is a quadrillion floating operations per second.
Per second.
Yeah, quadrillion. And the first supercomputer to hit that and break that barrier was another IBM machine, the Roadrunner. Meep, meep. And it had 20,000 CPUs, and it was the first computer to break that petaflop barrier. So 1,000,000,000,000 floating operations per second. It's a serious machine.
It's a lot of math.
Chris and I will return to discussing supercomputers in just a moment after this quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 2010, there was an interesting development because China entered the supercomputer fray. Now, at this point, it was really a battle down between the United States and Japan, and Germany also has quite a few supercomputers as well. But U.S. and Japan were the ones that were stealing the record back from between each other. And then China came out with a computer, which I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce because I don't know how to pronounce Chinese, but Tianhe is how it would be spelled in English. And and someone's probably going to say it's Xinhe or something like that.
Well, yeah, if you know how to pronounce that, please let us know.
Yeah, because I don't. But it was a computer from China that could run at 2.5 petaflops. And it had 14,336 Intel Xeon X5670 CPUs and 7,168 NVIDIA Tesla GPUs. And so that was, you know, a really impressive machine that was that stole all the titles away in 2010. But also another important moment for China in that year was that China developed the Sunway, which was slow by supercomputer standards because it could only run a petaflop.
Right.
And they had already gotten up to 2.5 petaflops. Petaflop is still incredibly fast, people. I'm just
slow
in general terms here, relative terms. But the cool thing about the Sunway, at least from China's perspective, is that it was the first supercomputer China had designed with all Chinese processors.
Oh, okay.
So they weren't depending upon some other company's processor or some other country's processors. They wanted to be able to be self-reliant when it came to developing computers. And so the China really pushed its computer engineering industry and was able to design, you know, the Chinese engineers were able to design this supercomputer. Then you had Fujitsu's K supercomputer, which until recently held the record. It was capable of running up to 10 petaflops with 88,128 SPARC 64 processors. And each CPU had 16 gigabytes of local RAM, and it had 1,377 terabytes of memory. And eventually it got up to 705,000 processor cores.
Yep. It sits in Japan's Riken Advanced Institute for Computational Science.
It sits and it thinks.
That's funny. It's ASCII, only spelled in different, I mean, the letters are in different.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. I just noticed that as I was looking down at my notes. That's actually sort of why we decided to do this now, because it was just the week that we're recording this that we found out about the test. Now, they do these tests twice a year. Every 6 months, they have the top 500 supercomputer sites. So computers from all over the world, they put them on wheels at the top of this big hill and push it down the hill.
It's a slot car race.
It's like a big computer soapbox derby.
Yeah.
No, they give them problems to solve and see who's the fastest, the top 500 supercomputers in the world, which in a way is kind of silly. But at the same time, very, very cool. And you can actually see the results of this if you want to. If you go to top500.org, there are the organizations that put it on, publish this every year, and that happens to be the University of Mannheim, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and the University of Tennessee actually do this, and they are trying to figure out the fastest. And the fastest was just announced. The new fastest was just announced this week, and we thought that would be a great time to talk about it. It's a machine actually named for a tree.
Yes, it is the IBM Sequoia.
Mm-hmm.
And when we say recording this week, the date is June 22nd, 2012. And so the Sequoia has taken the title of fastest supercomputer, which means that that's from IBM. So it means the USA has the title once more. At least until the next supercomputer Olympics. And,
it has a giant gold medal that is stamped on the outside of the machine.
You know, so you're probably all asking, hey, so what are some stats on this, this Sequoia computer? How fast can it go and what's making it tick?
Well, I do want to point out that it is owned by the Department of Energy. So this isn't really a military machine.
necessarily.
It is at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And yes, the specs on this are pretty impressive. I mean, it uses 790 kilowatts.
Yeah.
Which is actually fairly efficient for a supercomputer.
Yeah, it has 1,572,864 processors and 1.6 petabytes of memory.
Mm-hmm.
It takes up 3,422 square feet of space. So we've finally gotten back to those enormous computers. Remember, the stretch was 2,000 square feet. Now this one's 3,422 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it can run at 16.32 petaflops. So 6.32 petaflops faster. Well, not even quite that much, because the K eventually got up to 10.5. But it is significantly faster than the K. So IBM now holds the distinction of having the fastest, or having designed the fastest supercomputer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought it'd be kind of fun to compare that to IBM's Watson computer, because that made headlines last year when Watson was designed in part to compete against humans in a very human game. Because we've already talked about computers playing chess against humans. We've also talked about computers playing other games against humans. In fact, we did a full episode about this particular computer.
We sure did.
So IBM's Watson was designed to play in a game show. Let's make a deal. So they called out Watson and
it didn't know which door the goat
was behind.
Well, it was. It did have a dress on.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Let's make a deal. It was Jeopardy, and in Jeopardy, of course, you are given an answer. You have to come up with the appropriate question, and it's really tricky for a computer to do this, because it's not just a matching game where you match an answer to a question. You also have to take in context. Sometimes there's wordplay. Sometimes there's a riddle. It's a lot more complicated than just question answer.
Yeah, they specifically wanted it to play a human game. They didn't alter the clues. They're actually clues in this show. If you've never seen it, they give you the answer and you are supposed to supply the question. And they use wordplay and things in these clues. And they specifically want, the IBM engineers specifically wanted it to play a human game to test its natural language processing ability.
Yeah.
Can it figure out what, from context, what it is you're talking about? And it did very well.
Yeah. So what was powering the Watson, if you want to compare it to, say, the Sequoia?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it had it was using 90 IBM Power 750 servers in 10 server racks.
Mm-hmm.
And it had 16 terabytes of memory and 2,880 processors, or processor cores, I should say, not just processors.
Yeah.
And so 2,880, that sounds like a lot. But then you compare that to the 1,572,864 processors that the Sequoia has, and you realize that Watson, as far as supercomputers go, doesn't merit mention.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, you know, which, again, Watson was designed for a very specific purpose. This whole natural language, being able to recognize that and being able to come up with information, that's a very specialized computer. So it doesn't necessarily have to have this incredible, by comparison, processing speed and number crunching ability.
Right.
Which might be used for other very intensive tasks. So things like very, very realistic simulations, that kind of thing, and predictions.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to compare that so that people could understand, because Watson's one of those words that we've heard a lot about, and we think of that as like a supercomputer. But really, if we define supercomputer as a computer that is on that bleeding edge of what a computer is capable of doing, it doesn't measure up.
But when you talk about comparing the top 500 or putting a computer in a chess match or in a game of Jeopardy, I made the joke that it was a little silly, and yeah, you could say that you're using a computer. You could be using it for scientific purposes or doing something, and instead you're taking time off to do something else. But really, it's nice that, for one thing, people understand what it is a supercomputer is and can do, and also it's a way to test out these machines and make them better. Like I was talking about the power used by the Sequoia machine, it's considerably more efficient than the K computer. The 7,890 kilowatts beats K's 12,659 kilowatts. Mm-hmm. So with every time that they come out with a new supercomputer, it's more efficient. They find better ways to route instructions, and they can make things smaller than before. So you really do see the implications in our everyday computers, because now we have multi-core processors in these everyday devices that we use. You don't necessarily need that to write a letter or surf the internet, but it does make things faster and more efficient. Mm-hmm. Computers are more reliable. You see advances in operating systems that we use every day because the things that they found out in the process of making these supercomputers, they find better ways to route instructions in a simpler computer. And so it's really worth it to do these tests and find out just what a computer can do. So, you know, having a challenge just for the fun of it, you know, I don't see that necessarily as a bad thing. You know, especially when we can make advances and build on those for the next generation of machines.
Yep. And just to kind of sum this up, I thought I would just kind of a fun fact. If you look at the top 10 fastest supercomputers in the world, three of them are in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Two of them are in Germany. Two of them are in China. And the other three are in Japan, Italy, and France.
And that's it for this classic episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Again, it was recorded in 2012. We've had bigger and better supercomputers come out since then. And we've also seen the rise of graphics processing units that have largely supplanted supercomputers in many, but not all, applications. I've done other episodes about that. You can search our archive if you want to see those. The way you do that is you pop on over to our website, techstuffpodcast.com. We have the archive there. It is searchable, so you can look for specific episodes that cover, you know, specific topics. Maybe you don't see the topic you want. Maybe you do a search and nothing comes up. Well, then you can write me an email and suggest that topic to me. The address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or you can pop on over to Facebook or Twitter. We have the handle techstuffhsw at both of those. You can send us a suggestion that way as well. And I hope to talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.